The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. In this programme, the editors of a new book on race, punk and riots share their top punk tunes of all time. And in a bid to settle this once and for all, Pink Eyes from Fucked Up tells us why it's fine to like early Screwdriver. He does talk about other stuff. It's not an exclusively Screwdriver-centric interview for anybody worrying. In Singles Club, we'll be listening to tracks by Joe Goddard, King Creosote and Skylar Grey. That's all to come in Music Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio this week, Alex Needham and Michael Hann. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Alexis.
How you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. How are you? I'm fine. I'm grand, actually. What have you been up to? Anything exciting?
Music-wise, being glad I wasn't at Reading.
It looked awful, didn't it? It looked, unless you're 14. Michael, you're not a festival goer, are you?
Well, I'm going to End of the Road this weekend to see American Men with Beards and Acoustic Guitars singing about
death. It's the Michael Hann Festival.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I kept in touch with the young people. I went to see Fucked Up last week.
Oh, we've got them on the show later
as
on.
As you were saying.
Why did you not want to be at the Reading and Leeds Festival, Alex?
Well, I've been to Reading and Leeds quite a lot. I prefer Leeds being from there. And also it's a bit of a more friendly environment. You tend to get the entire music biz at Reading. And also just the fact it's a big flat airfield, it must be the most kind of, it's the most no-frills festival ever, although the lineup's always very, very kind of good. Mm. But I don't know, looking through the pictures of it, and I did look at tons of them, people under 30, not in the audience, but as bands seem to be at a premium. A lot of the bands were ones that I saw 8 years ago. So I suppose it's just the ever-decreasing pool of indie bands you have to pull in power to headline.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting this year, the number of emo bands on the road. I know there's always been emo at Reading, but there's this sense that it was kind of fading, but suddenly they all seem to be back and in high positions on the bill as well. I mean, Jimmy Eat World, I didn't realise people were interested in them 10 years ago, let alone now.
It's funny to see that My Chemical Romance were headlining. I mean, they were bottled 5 years ago, but I think emo actually has taken over. The indie kids have receded.
I think it absolutely,
and the
has.
Emos are totally on the ascendant.
If you look, I live in a sixth form college in Brighton, and if you look at the kids from there, you don't really see kind of indie kids anymore. You just see loads and loads and loads of emo kids, which is intriguing. So the sort of, I guess, the kind of people that were bottling My Chemical Romance 5 years ago aren't there anymore.
They're the people doing the conga to madness in mid-afternoon now.
There are the people still turning up to see BDI. That's what they're doing.
No, definitely. Yeah. One other thing that always strikes me as well, living very close to Camden High Street as I do, is how kind of old skate punk styles have taken over the mainstream so completely. Like, everyone's got stretched earlobes and massive sleeves.
I've been noticing stretched earlobes recently, increasingly on men of an age that I think you should be thinking down, sitting down and thinking about your mortgage rather than thinking about the length of your earlobes.
Stretched waistline.
But of course, Camden High Street isn't a kind of wholly accurate judge of the state of British youth, no, given that most of them are school parties from Seville.
Well, look, this is a fascinating, though, this discussion is. We'll hear more from you both in just a few minutes in Singles Club. But before that, let's do this. Whenever there's a new book out, it's usually pegged to some anniversary. But when the editors of White Riot had finished compiling interviews for their book about punk rock and the politics of race, which was intended to come out for the 30th anniversary of the Brixton riots, they must have lucked out, because London started rioting all over again. Earlier, I spoke to the editors Stephen Dunmore and Maxwell Tremblay about the book and a playlist they've made just for us that tells the story of White Riot.
White Riot is the quintessential articulation of what Jeff Chang calls a radical whiteness. And I think that in some ways we use that because it really has all the complicated notions of the racial identity of punk rock, which is at one and the same time, it's a radical articulation of racial solidarity and anti-racist sentiment. At the same time, and this is why it's so open to being misconstrued, it's really an articulation of whiteness and a defining of the punk scene as white.
Then we go on to Rock and Roll Nigger by Patti Smith. Why have you chosen this? Is that just a sort of... Well, why have you chosen that?
Yeah, I mean, we purposely started our book, actually, with a non-punk piece, which was Norman Mailer's White Negro. Because what we're trying to point out is that punk actually fits into a long line of bohemian cultural expressions of being able to and desiring to identify with the other as a way to free oneself from white bourgeois restrictions. And Patti Smith's Rock and Roll Nigger is exactly within that tradition. And that haunts punk rock for 40 years.
Presumably the most controversial choice on this list, you have put in White Power by Screwdriver.
We had to.
White Power, 1, 2, 3, 4! Was my country going down the drain? We are all at fault now. We are all to blame. We're letting them take over. We just let them come. Once we had an empire, and now we've got a slum.
What sort of reaction? I mean, you say you had to. What sort of reaction has that drawn from people? Are people pissed off that you've done that?
Well, yes. I'm pissed off that we've done that, and we just had a review in which the reviewer was fantastic because what he said was, it made me very uncomfortable. And we wanted to make people uncomfortable because there's a very uncomfortable history of punk rock, which is aligned with white power.
This is not to say that we're endorsing anything like that, but the idea is to not repeat the mistake of so many just knee-jerk anti-racist punks and say that Nazism itself is the target, but rather to actually look very closely at what a lot of these white power punk bands are doing from a kind of scholarly perspective, and to think about both the differences and the strange continuities between the ways they articulate themselves and the way the more, say, mainstream status quo of punk rock articulates itself.
My last question, I want you both or collectively to pick one song out of this list we should play out on. What should it be and why?
And well, I think if there were, say, one that would kind of make at least a lot of the argument of the book, I believe it's one of the last tracks on the playlist, The Power of Medusa by Antiproduct, which is then really the most recent song on the playlist, but also one of the most potent and relevant for where race and punk rock is at this moment, which is it's very much about a Puerto Rican woman trying to come to terms with white standards of beauty both outside the punk scene and within the punk scene.
And one final thing. If we were to then have one more, exactly, you can see how this is going to expand. It would be a song from a punk band that we don't know about in Jakarta, in Mexico City, in Brazil, and so on and so forth. Because that's where punk has gone. And when it moves to those places, the binaries of black and white, or even white and Latino, just don't work anymore. And instead, punks in those countries work out their own conflicts, and punk evolves in that way.
White Riot is available from the 5th of September. You can also see the playlist on the Music Weekly blog. Okay, Time for some new tracks in our singles club. Here's the first one. This is Michael's Choice. That's Skylar Grey, Dance Without You, Michael's Choice for this week's podcast. I admit, when I first started listening to that track, I started to mock, but I stayed to marvel. I thought at the beginning, I thought it sounds like Michael having a go himself, frankly. But once you started singing and the song got going, I thought it was really good. Tell us about Skylar Grey.
Well, she's someone who's made a big success for herself over the past year, 18 months, as a commercial songwriter for hire. She was behind the big Eminem Rihanna hit, Love the Way You Lie. And now she's launching herself on a solo career. What's interesting for me is that this isn't the single. This isn't the single that she's coming out with in the UK next month. Incredibly picked a bland ballad called Invisible to send her out to the market. But this has been a single in the US, and it clearly should be the single here. I mean, like you, everything about it is calculated to make me mock. I have quite a low tolerance for angst-ridden, hate-myself, gothisms, especially from, you know, people who are attractive and successful.
Mm. Also, you know, the human beatbox.
The human beatbox at the beginning.
A little of the human beatbox goes a very, very long way, I always find. But anyway.
But it's one of those utterly persuasive records. I mean, that genre, angst-ridden commercial goth, periodically throws out absolutely undeniable singles, and I think this is one of those. I love the way that in that first verse, after a voice comes in, the pitch slightly changes. It's just slightly changing key. It's almost as if they're turning it into focus just in time for the chorus. Then this huge juggernaut of a chorus comes in. There's great hooks all the way through it. And I can absolutely forgive the fact that I know that in, you know, 6 months' time, this is a record that's going to have 14-year-old girls across the country going, "You don't understand. This is the story of my life." Because it's a great pop single.
I like it too. I do like it. Is it representative of the rest of her material? Is it?
She plays pretty heavily on the darkness. Really? I don't mean Justin Hawkins. I have to confess, I knew almost nothing about her. She was just a name that was around. I knew she'd written some stuff until Paul Lester wrote a piece for this week's Film and Music about this new wave of women who are trying to combine dark material with commercial pop.
Does this include Lana Del?
Lana Del Rey's not in the piece, but yeah, she's clearly of that ilk. And so I started digging around stuff on YouTube, and I mean, there's some stuff about her that's calculated to make you cringe. She's best friends with Marilyn Manson, and they read books about torture together and watch extreme sex videos together. You're just, come on, just go and watch Downton Abbey like normal people. But
it'd be amazing if she was watching Downton Abbey with Marilyn Manson. That'd be fantastic.
But you know, again, as I say, I can forgive all that. I mean, I think it's one of those things where actually her being a commercial songwriter means that she can make the very most out of the ingredients that are put into this. There's a really imaginative twist given to, well, what are frankly at times kind of sub-9-inch nailisms.
Interesting, sub-9-inch nailisms. Alex?
Well, I wasn't too partial to it, and actually maybe it was because it did seem... It almost doesn't seem long enough has elapsed since we had the kind of mid-90s glossy MTV expensive videos done in a very grungy way. You know, the fact that she's...
Who are you talking about when you say that?
Well, kind of when you think that Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails suddenly broke through with very kind of dark videos, but also it, as an aesthetic, it took over everything. Like on one level, you know, you even had En Vogue making videos like that. You know, everything was very kind of post-grunge. You know, Garbage are a good example. You know, it's sort of...
Yes, it does sound a bit like Garbage, doesn't it? It does. I hadn't thought about that at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of... It's sort of records that came out of a particular... Or they took a particular subculture which had gone massive at the starting point and then made it very glossy, studio and commercially successful. And I can see that it's clever and what... You know, and what it's trying to do, but it just leaves me pretty cold.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point about it being a commercial record is crucial. I mean, it bears the same relationship to Nine Inch Nails as Evanescence do to Sisters of Mercy. I mean, kind of Evanescence is the point of reference that came to mind, this unexpected juggernaut of a pop single that has sort of emerged from a subculture, but, you know, really it's a pop record.
It's quite interesting that it's got the R&B thing combined with kind of down-tuned guitars.
Yeah.
There seems to be a bit of a kind of metal R&B thing creeping in. There's that guy, the Weeknd, isn't there? Not that he's necessarily like that, but the
Weeknd. What great, sorry, what great name. What are you going to call him, the Weeknd?
Well, I know.
But
is he
a metal guy? He must.
No,
be
he's
guy.
Not. He's an R&B guy.
He's the Weeknd, but without.
Oh, the Weeknd. Oh, right. Oh, him. Sorry. Sorry, of course I know his. I'm aware of his. He's the guy that sampled Susie and the Banshees, right?
Exactly, but goth hip hop, goth R&B is coming back. It's not weakened. It's
strengthened.
It's coming back stronger than ever.
Okay, well, look, that's Skylar Grey. I'm sure you can find that all over the internet because it's been a single in America. Time for our next track. This is My Choice.
Crossed out a lyric dessert. I rewrote the start with the stab at the end. I blotted out all that I wrote. Rubbed away distance. I smoothed out the folds. And those are honest words. It's the first time. All the lies untold, I'm waiting to choke them way down in my throat. Those are honest lies. Blindfolded, holding the tip.
That's King Creosote and John Hopkins. Honest Words, my choice for Singles Club this week. It's out next month, September. I sort of avoided the King Creosote and John Hopkins album for quite some time after I was sent it, partly because I've always liked the idea of King Creosote in theory, and I've always found the sort of reality. Some of his stuff's good, some of it's not. It's never been kind of as amazing as I kind of hoped his records would be. And I finally got around to playing it after it had been nominated for the Mercury Prize. And it's really, really, really good. I don't know what it is about the collaboration with John Hopkins that has caused Kenny, King Creosote, to sort of step his songwriting up a gear in the way that he has. But, I mean, it is a really sort of strongly kind of emotionally affecting record, or I found it very emotionally affecting record, in a way that I haven't really found that about that much Fence Collective stuff in the past. And I kind of hope it'll be an ongoing collaboration, because I think it's probably the best thing that either of them have done. And this single, Honest Words, which forms part of a 3-track EP, suggests that it might be. It's just like it's an ongoing thing rather than a one-off album. I just think that the backdrops that John Hopkins produces fit really well. They're kind of just shifting him a little bit further away from being your standard sort of acoustic singer-songwriter. I just think it's a really, really good record, and they're really good songs. There you go, very eloquently put. Alex, are you a fan?
I've not heard much of their stuff either, but I do like this. I like the fact that it has obviously been very kind of considered, like the harmonies are really beautiful in the chorus, and also every verse is different. It's obviously been very sort of sat down and thought about in a very producery way, but it's still got a kind of warmth and sort of random quality and a sweetness about it. Are these totally new songs? I thought that he'd actually gone back through King Creosote's back catalogue and sort of repurposed them.
Group King Creosote Ignorance is slightly shining through here.
Because he's one of those guys.
But they've remixed this album as well, though, haven't they? They've done a dub version of this album.
No, you're getting confused with Steve Mason, aren't you?
No. Oh, yes, I am.
From the Beta Band. That's that Dennis Bovell and Steve Mason thing. I don't know, is the short answer, if they're old King Creosote songs or not. I have not really, I guess, paid close enough attention to about the 30,000 King Creosote albums that I own.
Well, that's the thing, actually. There's so much King Creosote seems to come flying at you that it's hard to know where to begin. And I've been a bit like you, which is kind of, I kind of just don't know where to start. So actually, I'm not going to
start.
There's
a lot of them on the shelves.
Which is a shocking attitude. It is a very beautiful song. There's something about those soft, sudden Scottish accents sung in that tremulous quaver that's inordinately attractive. It's kind of one of the great songs, great sounds of indie music over the last 25 years, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I slightly feel at times if this record, they'll remove the vocals from it at some point and it'll be used to soundtrack slow motion footage of whales breaching the surface. It's not in that tremble puny humans before the awesome majesty of nature. It's the marvel at the gentle beauty.
There's a bit of footage knocking about on YouTube at the moment of an deaf eight-month-old baby being fitted with some sort of ear implant that enables it to hear for the first time. And it's an amazing piece of footage. It smiles at his mum. He recognises the voice and smiles at him. That sort of thing you could put in the background of this.
Although John Hopkins used the soundtrack Sex and the City.
Did he?
He did, yes.
Wow.
His first album was licensed to them.
Is that right?
Yeah.
God. I wholeheartedly recommend The King Creosote and John Hopkins. I really hope it wins the Mercury, actually, because it is it's just a brilliant... The last track, last two tracks, and particularly the last track, a track called Your Young Voice, I was making the kids breakfast a couple of weeks ago and dealt such an emotional sucker punch to me that I was sort of, you know,
was, you didn't cry.
I didn't cry, but
you,
I was...
You put creosote in their porridge.
yeah, absolutely. that's out next week. The other thing I was going to say, actually, is that I find the Fence Collective stuff tends to work better when they have a bit of a dance or ambient or electronic element in it. There's a great single came out at the start of last year by the Pictish Trail called Winter Home Disco that was produced by Hot Chip, which brings us to Alex's choice.
Hang your head in shame for these wounds. I cannot stay. You've gone too far. You broke my heart. You've gone too far.
Okay, that was Joe Goddard of Hot Chip featuring Valentina with Gabriel. I think this is an absolutely brilliant, brilliant record. I heard it a couple of weeks back. Online, it's on SoundCloud, and I just think it's wicked. It's manages to be a sort of anthemic dance floor tune without being in any way an anthemic dance floor. You know what I mean? A craven anthemic dance floor tune. It's just a really good song. It's brilliantly produced. Great effects, all that kind of malarkey. Alex, tell us about it. Tell us why you brought it in.
It has got great effects.
Yeah,
I mean, when I heard it, I heard it on the radio at the weekend, and it just immediately kind of cut through. I've always liked everything that Hot Chip have done, pretty much, and I like the Two Bears, which is Joe Goddard's other project this summer. But this, I think he took the song by the singer, who's called Valentina, and apparently it was a sort of a folky number when he first came across it, but he persuaded her to allow him to house it up, and I think it's been really successful. I like the fact that it's almost like a kind of a compendium of good house music of the last sort of 10-20 years, but not in a kind of horrible sort of cheesy knowing way. He says himself that it nods to another record called Gabriel, which was by Roy Davis
Jr.
Which was a bit of a UK garage classic, and they have got a sort of similar atmosphere actually, which is sort of happy, sad, minor key, quite melancholic, but at the same time it's sort of hands in the, you know, it's hands in the air.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. It's got that kind of melancholy deep house thing going on. Yeah, Gabriel. I did think about the Roy Davis Jr. track. Actually, it does have a sort of similar vibe and a similar beat to it. Michael.
Well, I've been hearing that out a lot at the club.
I imagine you have. Yeah.
No, I like this as well. I think you'd have to be adult not to, really. I love the way that the vocals are treated. I don't know if they've been cut up or something, but it sounds as if every single word has been cut
and re-spliced
back into the tape separately to give it that kind of halting, jerking feeling that kind of adds to the sense of melancholy. there are times we're just getting into the section when we listen to it back here in the studio where it faded out just at the point where I think it sounds a little like they've taken one of the backing tracks from the last Hot Chit. Hot Chit.
I beg your
pardon. It was Hot Chit. It wasn't an S. A Hot Chit is something I had at the betting track the other day, and I won. You can tell it comes from the hands of Joe Goddard anyway. Yeah. Put it that way, as it says in terms of the chord progressions. But also, it's one of those songs that would actually be better the longer it went on. You know, at 5.5 minutes, I didn't actually feel like I'd had enough. I could have listened to it for another 5 minutes comfortably.
Okay, well, yeah, I thought that was great. I think that's 3 thumbs up. I think a possible hit as well, maybe. I don't know, is music like this getting the charts now? It kind of doesn't, does it?
I don't think
good music. It doesn't really. Well, it doesn't.
All right, 40, old man.
Oh, come on, the top 40 at the moment. What a load of fucking bollocks. I mean, really, let's not be. What's good in the top 40? Nothing. Nothing. Have you seen seen the release schedules for this? I was like looking on HMV. A big album's coming out this winter. What a load of bollocks.
What is coming out this winter?
Well, the big albums, I suppose, Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds and Coldplay are the two big albums.
Michael, looking forward to both?
Absolutely ever.
I have no strong feelings about either, actually. You know.
There's a load of old people, like, you know, Pink Floyd box sets and all these big box sets.
It's good, though, that the world is getting three different versions of every Pink Floyd album. For people who haven't heard them before...
I'm actually quite into here, but that's another story. I would quite happily sit through about 6 CDs of Wish You Were Here.
Man, you sold out. You used to just be Piper at the Gates of Dawn.
You know, they're doing a Syd Barrett one next year. They're doing a Pink Floyd era Syd Barrett.
Is it going to have Vegetable Man and Scream
Like
That Scream on it?
It is, and it's going to have loads of... They've Nick Mason has found a tape of them doing kind of R&B stuff in late 1965 and so on. So it should be really interesting. Anyway, that's by the way. And then the rest of it is like people who won X Factor last year. That's the rest of the release schedule. Matt Cardle, Rebecca Ferguson. It's a load of crap.
That's right. That's
I bet there are some other things, Alexis. I bet. I'll go back downstairs and look through the release schedules, and I bet you I will find some albums that are not by either Superstars or X Factor contestants.
No,
I bet you there's a King Creosote album. There's probably two or three before the end of the year.
Eight things on the Fence Collective. Anyway, look, we've got off the point. Stuff like this doesn't get in the charts anymore, does it?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, I don't think Hot Chip have ever had a hit.
Did Over and Over not hit?
It was a minor hit, I think. I think it was just ubiquitous rather than actually purchased.
What's the world coming to?
I think now there's the whole kind of currency of music has changed completely, hasn't it? It's there's a great divide between which is kind of the stuff that's played on daytime Radio 1 and is a huge hit and sort of everything else. But when you think there's never been such a stranglehold on kind of commercially successful music, it almost is divvied up between about 10 acts now.
It is, and also it's, I think there's a sense in which everything has become incredibly homogenised. Maybe this, I thought this was a function of age until I spoke to an R&B fan and they went, no, everything does sound the same at the moment. Well, and it's because R&B's gone a bit like David Guetta kind of housey.
Yeah, it's not so much that it's acts, isn't it? It's the stables. So, you know, there's a David Guetta stable of things that he produces and writes for and releases himself. There's a Chase and Status stable of acts that they've signed or produce or are themselves and so on. And that's why everything is sounding roughly the same, because you might get 10 different singles by 10 different acts, but fundamentally it's the same. It's the same guiding, sinister, controlling mind behind it all.
And on that note, we will leave Singles Club. Now, we're going to come back to the race thing for a second time in this programme. A few months back, you may remember, we got into a bit of hot water, well, kind of did lukewarm water, tepid water, with Damien Abraham, a.k.a. Pink Eyes from Fucked Up. We mentioned his love of Screwdriver, a band that most famously are associated with the far right in Britain. He got in touch in the comments board. I think it's probably fair to say the most thoughtful and interesting comment we've ever had about anything on Music Weekly came from the hand of Pink Eyes. Very, very long, absolutely fascinating thing. He sort of put things straight. You can hear about that in our show back in early June. We talked about it then. Well, Pink Eyes recently caught up with our man Lewis Patterson to discuss, among other things, the whole Screwdriver issue. And he picks up the story there.
Being a fan of this podcast that I'm very flattered to be on now, I was listening to the podcast and was stoked to see my band mentioned and, you know, that we were going to be on the show and listen to it and, you know, was really, you know, listen to the review. And then all of a sudden there's this mention of the Screwdriver thing that I'd said years ago. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, because that's something you can never, noted that I was not in any way white power, but that's something you can never get away from. You know, like Biohazard, their first demo, the American Pride demo, has a song called White Power on it. You know, even though Evan is Jewish and, you know, has now a massive Star of David, and there is still always going to be that thing that follows them around. Like, there's no way to get away from that, you know. Or no, sorry, it's called American Pride. But anyway, it's a very obvious white powery type song, and I think he was probably just a young dumb kid saying that. But you know, you can never get away from that. So I felt obliged to respond, and responded in the typically wordy fashion. Maybe I'm more wordy now, actually explaining it.
I mean, let's talk about your recent album. It came out a few months ago. It's called David Comes to Life, and it's a rock opera set in a fictional British market town of the 70s.
Yeah, like, so we'd always kind of joked about, like, we're going to do a rock opera one day called David Comes to Life, and we had written even B-sides that have appeared on other singles that were supposed to be part of David Comes to Life, like David's Plan and David's Christmas were both originally supposed to be demos for songs that would appear on the David Comes to Life thing, even though we had no idea what the story was going to be. So then we end up winning this Polaris Award, you know, which is, the Polaris Award is like the Canadian Mercury Prize, I guess. Yeah. And, you know, here we have won this award on our second record, which means that no one's going to like our third record, because that's kind of the rule it goes, you know. Like, so we're like, well, let's just do whatever, let's do this rock opera thing that we've been kind of joking about.
I think when you first came through the UK, I remember seeing you tour around about Hidden World, and at the time I think that you were playing to mostly kind of sort of hardcore audiences,
yeah,
I think. You
were absolutely
doing sort of small club
mostly
tours.
Empty audiences. Right. That tour, that first tour of England was, bar none, the most grueling tour I think we've ever done. We did it over a Easter weekend, and we were doing two shows a day. So we're doing eight shows over that weekend, plus shows on either side, and we flew in. We're just like sleeping, you know, obviously sleeping on people's floors, sleeping in the van. But that was actually the first time we ever had any contact with the larger world. And it was Andy Capper, who is a editor of Vice. You know, he started talking about us kind of around the same time Plan B started talking about us. And it just kind of felt like, wow, this is, you know, like, I can't believe people are paying attention to our band, you know. It was the first place that anyone outside of hardcore took any notice of us. But yeah, as time has gone on, at the time we were getting a lot of love from Maximum Rock and Roll. Actually, it kind of timed out perfectly, because that was the crescendo of the love for Maximum Rock and Roll. And the beginning of some of the ire for Maximum Rock and Roll, and sort of the beginning of at least some mention from mainstream press. So we still felt acknowledged by print.
It's not necessarily easy to be loved by both Maximum Rock and Roll and the Enemy.
No, it is a very difficult line to tiptoe across. Maybe Ice Age is the only band currently pulling it off, or ever to pull it off.
I give them 12 months.
Yeah, that's so do I, because I think that's why hardcore survived, is because it keeps itself pure.
I mean, it's notable that although things have been toned down slightly, then you're still an extremely sort of rocking and visceral live band.
Yeah, like, I think it's because maybe I'm on the inside, I think it's seamless, the change, the transition from one band to the other. And, once again, I'm on the inside, so, you know, I kind of see how it happened. You know, not everyone probably agrees with me, but, yeah, like, I think we're still the same band. Like, I still kind of have I'm not straight edge anymore, granted. No one in the band is still straight edge. No one in the band is still vegan. There's still some vegetarians and stuff, but I still think we're still the same band. We've just changed over 10 years.
I'm interested, do you find yourself playing a kind of a different sort of set when, say, you're out there supporting Arcade Fire to what you would when you're playing sort of a tiny punk show?
You know what? I don't think so, but we recently did two shows opening for the Foo Fighters. The first night in Toronto, I'm like, I just tried, kind of did the same thing I did at the Arcade Fire and realized I was leaving a huge percentage of the audience out because they were not following me with a spotlight or anything. People couldn't see me. Mm. So the next night I actually changed it, like, which was kind of the first time I've ever adopted. I stayed on stage for a lot of the set, which I don't normally like to do because I feel weird up there. Like, I feel much more natural among the people in the audience, or at least able to kind of transition back and forth.
I mean, it's worth explaining for people that haven't seen Fucked Up Live, then you're usually sort of shirtless in the middle of the audience
with
sort of blood coming down your face occasionally.
Sometimes blood, definitely sweat, definitely sweat, hence why my shirt's off. I'm definitely...
How is your forehead holding up after all this time as well? I mean,
pretty good, relatively speaking. I had a really, not really severe, but I had a stitches incident a couple months back, just before we came over on tour. Where I smashed a glass on my head at a book launch for my friend's photography book. At
a book launch?
Well, I was performing. I don't want you to think I was just like grabbing champagne off the table. You know, this is very tame. I need to smash something on my head. So I grab a pint glass and have screwed up before with a pint glass breaking on my head and had to go to hospital. Still have a piece of glass stuck in my head right there. And I broke the glass against my head and split my head wide open and had to go to the hospital and get stitches. But... apart from that, I think I've got a very durable forehead. And one thing I'm doing now is kind of toning down the busting myself open stuff because I see kids doing it at our show.
Yeah.
I'll hand a kid a microphone thinking he's going to sing along. And next thing I know, he smacked himself in the forehead 6 or 7 times. And it's just like, I don't want to see that because I know I can take it. But I don't want to see a kid hurt themselves.
You don't want to set a bad example.
Yeah, like it's really weird to see that I'm now having to, you know, kind of censor myself in that regard. But, yeah, I just don't want to see a kid permanently hurt themselves because they think it's cool that a band's doing it.
That was Pink Eyes giving some life lessons to Louis Patterson. David Comes to Life by Fucked Up is out now. That's all for now. Thank you to Alex Needham and to Michael Hand. Thank you very much for coming, Alexis. I hope to see you again soon.
I'm sure you will.
We will be back next Friday. I'm Alexis Petridis. This programme was produced by Matt Hill. See you next week. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.